Hello, daring novelists, poets, essayists, and memoirists, and welcome to another episode of Right Minded. Today, we've got a special guest, a friend of mine, Joe Loya, who is a born storyteller and one who has one of the most interesting writer journeys that I've ever heard. He thought of himself as a writer as a boy, but he took a detour, or more than a detour, after a tumultuous childhood where he suffered chilling and really traumatic abuse. Joe became a bank robber for a number of years, and it wasn't until a long stint in solitary confinement in prison where he had an epiphany and decided to be a writer. I'm with my co-host, Brooke Warner, of course, and Brooke, Joe's story is riveting in so many regards, and we'll hear more from him on that. I thought one thing that would be pertinent to explore on the writing side is that Joe reached out to the wonderful writer, Richard Rodriguez, after he had the epiphany to be a writer, and they formed a pen pal type of correspondence that was really fundamental to his development. And the letters between Joe and Richard Rodriguez form some of the most lyrical passages in the book, and I was thinking about how finding a good mentor can be such an empowering, amazing thing, and how we all want that singular sage to drop into our life and then offer the crucial bits of guidance that will lift us to the next level. I've always wanted to have such a mentor, Brooke, but you can't just go out to the literary mentor shop and pick out a mentor. Have you had a mentor?
Yeah, I have had a few over the years, but they've been career mentors, right? So people who have taken me under their wings and generously shown me the publishing ropes, but not in my writing life. So I do know the deep generosity of that mentorship relationship. And I actually wrote about it quite a lot, a whole chapter dedicated to mentorship in Write On Sisters, which is my most recent book, including some famous mentor-mentee relationships like Joyce Carol Oates and Jonathan Safran Foer. And I wrote about the mentorship relationship actually that unfolded some 100 years earlier than that between Henry James and Edith Wharton. But I also talked about how important it is for writers to think about mentorship in a less targeted way, like instead of seeking particular mentors or feeling as if they should be making connections to people who might open that next door for them, that maybe they consider the type of people they want to have in their inner circle and why. Because I think about the fact that Liz Gilbert is most certainly a mentor to me, but she doesn't know it. You know, it's not like she's actively calling me up and offering me support and championing me.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah. One of these days. But she sets a strong example for how I want to show up in the world. And so in that way, she inspires me. And that's another form of mentorship, you know, that I think not enough people honor or maybe not enough people claim. So what's your experience been with mentorship, Grant?
Well, I think of this story. Years ago, I sent a fan letter to one of my favorite authors. This was, I don't know when, at least a couple decades ago, Dennis Johnson. And I sent along a few chapters for my novel, and I hoped he would, you know, like them, send them to his editor and agent, and that I'd live happily ever after, well-published and with a new best friend. That didn't happen, of course, but I'm glad I reached out to him, and I encourage others to do so. This was before the internet, so I actually mailed my novel to him, and I received a short note in response from him, you know, a few lines of advice typed on a scrap of paper. And I was initially discouraged, but I shouldn't have been. You know, I now view the letter as a really amazing act of generosity from such a writer. So like you, I've found that some of my best mentorships in life have actually been the imagined ones I have with my favorite authors, similar to how Elizabeth Gilbert is a mentor to you. I think one of the benefits of fandom is the study of another's work and life and all of its details, and to immerse oneself almost like an actor studying for a role is a good way to go. Someday, you know, I was thinking about this. Someday, in fact, I think it would be an interesting project to sit down and really think about all of the writing mentors in my life who didn't know they were writing mentors, and then write about what I learned from them. I think it'd be an interesting collage because, you know, some have been mentors for a moment and others have been there with me for a lifetime in some way. And that reminds me of one of our guests, Pico Iyer, who wrote an entire memoir about his lifetime relationship or mentorship with Graham Greene, which took place entirely through Graham Greene's books. So, and it was sufficient, you know, like in the end, I think Pico Iyer had the opportunity to meet Graham Greene and he declined, or he didn't want to know him too well. So what do you think makes for a good mentor, Brooke? If you could design a mentor for yourself, what would the relationship provide you?
Well, I can speak to my amazing mentor, Roy Carlisle, who's a local publisher here in the Bay Area, and what has made him a great mentor to me, both in my early years and it continues. You know, it's just that now we're more on equal footing because it's been 20 years and we're in the same industry. But how he absolutely championed me early on, he saw a spark in me, I think, in those early years when I was in my early 20s, and he encouraged it. He loved that I loved publishing as much as he did. And from the very beginning, he treated me as an equal. And at the same time, of course, he imparted so much wisdom that I didn't yet have because I was early on in my journey. And when we've gotten over, when we've gotten together over the years to talk shop, you know, he gave me lots of advice, but he also listened to me. And so, and then as I grew into my own, he wanted whatever that next thing was going to be for me. He never tried to steer me. I always felt like he was legitimately delighted by my success. And I think this is what makes a true mentor. You know, it feels amazing to be the mentee who has another person fully in your corner. So I felt seen by him, that he was someone I could contact to talk to about all parts of the industry, you know, the parts that drove me crazy, the parts I loved, the parts that confused me. And I think a good mentorship relationship involves sharing the love for the thing that brought you together in the first place. The mentor is ideally generous and enjoys their mentee and wants their success. And then the mentee in return respects the mentor, and there's room for growth in that relationship, right? So I definitely credit Roy with opening a lot of doors for me, you know, including helping me to get my first job in publishing. Undoubtedly wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for him. And then later supporting me to be on the board and later to be the board chair of the Independent Book Publishers Association, which has been a real cornerstone of connection and growth for me over the past 6 years. So it's really been a big deal to have a mentor like him in my corner over these two decades.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think a lot of people want mentors to open doors or to impart that, you know, special secret of writing that will provide the magic to make everything work. But I think a good mentor really helps you realize the vibrancy and validity of your creative self and delights in your growth and success, as Roy did. This is separate from mentorship, but I recently met with my writing group and I gave them a couple of very kooky stories that I didn't know how to evaluate at all. And what was interesting to me was how I didn't need the usual type of writing feedback about how to make the stories better. I just needed a type of validation. I needed to see that people enjoyed the stories because they were just so different. And I think mentors do something similar. They simply affirm that you're on the right track, and that is a very valuable and underrated thing. So mentorship can take different forms, and the things we need from mentors might not be the things we think we need, and it's worth reaching out to your favorite authors, just as Joe did to Richard Rodriguez.
Thanks for that, Grant. Yeah, I hope that listeners will take heed and reach out to someone or do what I'm doing with Liz Gilbert and just claim a mentor, because it actually is meaningful and, you know, it gives you someone to aspire to be like, right? And that's always good too. There are so many writers who've benefited from mentorship relationships over the years. And I just wanted to close with something from my friend Courtney Martin, who is a local writer and TED speaker, the author of The New Better Off. And she's written a lot about mentorship. And so I just thought I would share this few notes that she has from a post that she wrote on being, Krista Tippett's site. So there are 6 points here. Number one, express your gratitude early and often. Number two, make your mentor's life easier in some small way. Number three, remember that your mentor is not your mother. I like that one. Number four, don't expect perfection from your mentors. Number five, create a team of mentors, which is kind of what we've been talking about. And number six, be brave, which is about being true to yourself and listening to your own instincts. So you can't get more on point than that. And when we come back, we'll hear from Joe about his story, his relationship with Richard Rodriguez, and his unusual journey to becoming an author.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm excited to welcome our next guest, Joe Loya, because Joe and I first met years ago at a poker game, which I believe Joe won. I know I lost. Joe's bio is different than most writers. Joe is an American writer and former convicted bank robber. He grew up in Los Angeles and robbed banks in Southern California in the mid to late 80s until he began a 7-year prison sentence in Lompoc Federal Penitentiary. After his release in 1996, he wrote about prison life for the Pacific News Service, and he published his memoir, The Man Who Outgrew His Prison Cell, in 2005. Joe has also written for the screen. He contributed to Baby Driver, Queen of the South, and Taken, and he was recently the focus of a great podcast series called The Score, which I was riveted to, so I recommend it. Welcome, Joe, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, Joe, I want to talk about your journey as a writer, because your journey is unique compared to any guest we've had on. I know that when you were in prison, you had a month-long stint in solitary confinement that led to an epiphany, or maybe a hallucination, that drew you to writing, or back to writing, rather. So can you tell us a little bit about that time and that epiphany?
It was a year in solitary confinement, of almost 2-year stint in solitary confinement. Halfway through, I had this hallucination of this. Well, I went mad, slowly went mad in there, and I finally, it culminated in this hallucination in which this little boy showed up in my cell, 7-year-old little boy, bald head, and just stood there looking at me, and I thought, okay, I'm done, you know. This is terrible. I can't distinguish reality from fantasy anymore, so I'm in trouble. Just completely devastated by it, because I'd seen what happened to men when they go crazy in solitary confinement. They do terrible things. It's just humiliating, whatever. And I thought, okay, I'm on that spectrum now. But what happened when I woke up and I started thinking about that, you know, in my doom and gloom, I realized that, oh, I remember I had this 7-year-old kid, friend when I was 7 years old, and he had died of leukemia. And so this ancient memory comes to me. I was in solitary confinement, but I was in the basement of solitary confinement because I'd gotten out of my handcuffs and tried to stab someone. So I was put down there under investigation for a crime I committed while I was in solitary. And everyone down there were killers. They had broken an assistant warden's jaw. They had killed some other inmates on the line, whatever. All of us down there were really violent men and throwing shit on the guards and that kind of thing. It was terrible. But it was in that moment that I broke. I had my break. And so the kid visits me and I wrote about it. That ended up being a full story that I wrote. And it's the first story I ever wrote that would eventually make it into the memoir.
Wow, Joe, it sounds like that was essentially a visitation that really changed your life. And so thank you for sharing the genesis of that. And we know that you've referred to the writer Richard Rodriguez as a mentor. And so many writers want a mentor figure in their lives, especially early on. So how did that happen? And how did he help you become a writer?
I told him, you know, listen, I'm an ex-con. You found that out. I'm enrolled at Boston University. I didn't want to tell you, but here we are. You finally know. Thank you for the books. Like, I feel like Renfell with my hand already halfway in Dracula's pocket, asking for like some crumbs off the table. But hey, would you be interested in a correspondence with me? And so for 2 years, we had a correspondence.
Wow.
Reading his letters. When you're in prison, you get letters from people, especially like from someone like Richard, who was man, his style of writing is just fantastic. I don't know. Have either of you read him, or do you just know him?
I was going to say, yeah, he's a great writer. And that's what impressed me so much about you reaching out to him, that he, you know, saw you as a fellow writer. You know, I just think that's so magical.
Well, the second letter, he even said it. He was like, you're a writer already. I'll help you get published when you get out. But you're a writer. So that was helpful. One thing I want to say is that reading his letters over and over and over. I would read sometimes his letters 20 times before I even wrote back. So getting somebody's their cadence, their paragraphs, the way they end sentences, the way they pivot, locomotion, all of that from a great writer who, like in Philip LePate's book, The Art of the Personal Essay, it starts with Seneca and it ends with Rodriguez. So he's a great essayist, and I was learning to write from that guy because I was just reading his sentences and taking them in and sometimes mimicking them back a little bit.
That's a great way to learn. And I know, Joe, that you've also served as a mentor. It's interesting to me that Piper Kerman, who wrote Orange is the New Black, mm-hmm. reached out to you while she was in prison, and she didn't know you, just as you didn't know Richard Rodriguez. And Piper's been on the podcast. So I was wondering if you could tell us about your role as a correspondent, mentor, and fellow prison reform advocate to Piper.
You know Laura Fraser, from the Grotto?
Yeah.
Okay. So Laura Fraser, you know, I was at the Grotto back in 2002 to 2004. Anyway, Laura Fraser sent an email out saying, hey, Piper, Larry's girlfriend, is in prison, and she needs paperback books, and anyone could send those. That'd be great. And I didn't know her from Adam, but I knew Larry. So I sent her a letter and said, hey, listen, this is what Rich Rodriguez told me once. He said, it's better to write to strangers because you don't have anything to lose. I don't know you. You don't have to please me. You don't have to tell me anything to coddle me. You could just be yourself. Everyone you love has some investment in you and hearing something in your tone, and you won't want to share all the stuff you're going to grapple with. I know that because when I was in prison for the things I did, it was hard to tell the people I love what I was really going through. So with me, you can do that just like Richard did for me. Mm-hmm. And I offered her that. So the entire time that she was there for that year, a little over a year that she did, we had a back and forth. And very quickly, I was like, listen, here's what you need to do. Every day, write the funniest thing you heard, and write all of the tragic, saddest thing you heard. And if you can unpack it as a story, even better. But at the end of the year, you're going to have both of these, and you'll have a book. You should imagine writing a book. She was like, no, I'm not a writer. Larry's a writer. I'm like, I don't want to hear all that nonsense. Do the same thing. I just push back against. Anytime anyone tells me they're not a writer, I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever.
That's so great, Joe, because it's like tough love as a mentor, which is like part of what it's about, right? So I want to ask you a question about just living through trauma, you know, and growing up and having this story to tell, because we've talked to a lot of people about being able to write about traumatic events in their lives, something that we focus on the show from time to time. So in preparation for this interview, I read a scene where your father requires you to memorize 144 mathematical equations. You're 9 years old and you missed five of them. So he whipped you for missing those five. And this was clearly traumatizing. And it's traumatizing to read, right? When you defend yourself after years of abuse by stabbing him, these are such intense scenes. And I'm wondering, you know, I'm imagining it's traumatizing to have to relive those experiences. And do you have any advice for people who are writing trauma about how to protect themselves from re-traumatizing themselves?
What I tell people to do all the time when they come to me, how do I write a memoir? My first advice is write all the stories that you tell about yourself to people, but just in a line. Like I, when I wrote my memoir, started writing it, I want to write all the stories. I was like, arrest at UCLA, stabbing my dad, funeral, you know, kissing my mother's cold hand in her casket, the divorce, earthquake, and things. Like I would just do this thing. I would do it. And then I would go and I would unpack each story. But back in the day, I had no sense that I wasn't prepared to handle one story that day. I would just do it willy-nilly, like, oh, I got 4 hours. Let me just go see which one could take up 4 hours of writing. And I may have been sensitive that day, and I would take on some heavy story, and it would devastate me for 2 weeks because I wasn't measuring myself, scanning my body to say, what can I handle today? I was just saying, what? Let me just go do it because writing is writing. What I realized and what I discovered, and I caution people about this all the time, if you are writing devastating material, it is going to fuck you up. It just will. And so what you need to do is you need to approach it with strategies. You need to get a cadre of people who are always aware that you are going into write material that might be dangerous. I remember when I was a boy, one of the things I learned about the temple when it was being first made in the Old Testament, where they had this one back section that was so holy, the Holy of Holies, that like the priest before he went in there, there was all these rituals he had to do. And if he did any of them wrong, you would hear in the inside of the Holy of Holies was a thump. The body would drop and God would just say, you didn't do it right. You got to die. And what would happen is they had, he would be tethered though, because nobody could go in there. They had to pull him out. And that's how it is with this stuff. If you're investigating this thing and it's kicking your ass, the reason you call your friends is so they can pull you out of it. They can rescue you and say, all right, man, you're out of the darkness. Yeah, it was hard. We hear you. Too bad that happened. We love you. You know, you help the people manage the grief that comes up. I remember this one scene I wrote in the book that you were kind of talking about. My dad dunked my brother's head in the water. It's the most traumatic event of my entire life. He dunked my brother's head, tried to drown him practically because he's so mad at my brother, and I just sat there helpless. It was 6 months later, I would stab and try to kill my dad. But that scene, I must have edited that scene to make it have its most impact. I had to keep revisiting that scene to edit it. And every fucking time I pushed back away from the desk when I was done, and I would just sob. I wouldn't cry. I would sob. It is that grief that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. And it is the one grief that still, even just talking about now, I get choked up because it is just so powerful. It's overwhelming. But now, after all these years of practice and understanding what I'm doing, when I go to write a tough piece, I make sure that I'm right. I take a body scan, like, where am I? Who am I? What's going on in my life? What are things? Am I stressed out? Am I able? Am I capable to handle this thing? Okay, it is. I call my friends and my family. I'm going to go do this work. It's going to be hard work. I'm trying to achieve this tone. I'm trying to achieve this to convey some emotion out of it, which means I'm going to have to revisit things that are super painful. I love you guys. Back my play when I go in here. Make sure you got me tethered around the ankle in case I fall in my holy of holies. And that's what it is. You just got to have strategies to go in and emotionally to excavate that stuff, because you're going to get taken. It is going to kick your ass. This is just a given. And if you're not careful and you're just, you know, willy-nilly and indiscriminate with your emotions about handling this, it will devastate you again and again and again. So that's my advice. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, thanks, Joe.
Yay. Thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Joe. We'll be right back with today's book talk.
Welcome back, everyone, to today's book talk. I've chosen a book that is kind of a mentor guide to me, I guess. It's by Sally Mann. It's her book, Hold Still. And if you don't know Sally Mann, she's this wonderful photographer. And I initially loved her photographs. And then I saw a documentary about her life. And then I heard that she'd written this amazing memoir, that she was a wonderful writer as well as a photographer. And it made me think about how I've always thought that photographers and writers share a kinship. Like, we both like to kind of stand in the back of the room and witness things and watch things and think about them and then record them. And so anyway, I'm a photographer hobbyist and love her photos and just began her memoir. And it's just absolutely wonderful on so many different levels. I mean, she's a true Southern storyteller, and she evokes the South and her sense of place in so many interesting ways. That's another thing I love about her, is her sense of place. But she has this quote. I'm just going to share this. I've been mulling it over all week. She wrote at the beginning of the book, she wrote, "Insecurity for an artist can ultimately be a gift, albeit an excruciating one." And the reason I have been thinking about that is that, you know, insecurity usually hinders art. It usually hinders us in all of our lives. And so I like to think about how it can actually deepen you as an artist. And I think for me, when my answer to that quote is that it makes me try harder. My insecurity makes me search for ways to be secure, which makes me go deeper in my art and work harder at it. I'd be curious to ask Sally Mann what she exactly meant by that. Maybe someday I will. So yeah, I recommend Hold Still by Sally Mann.
Thanks, Grant. And everybody, Right Minded is a weekly podcast. Thank you for being dedicated listeners. One thing we'd like to ask is that you recommend it to a writer friend. We've been asking for reviews and ratings over these weeks, but getting it in your feed, subscribing, sharing with a friend, all that stuff is ways that you can let us know that maybe we're being mentors to you in some way. We hope we are. And so we're grateful to everybody, and we will see you next week.